My name is Rob Auchincloss, and this is the Holocene Podcast, where we seek information from the most creative, adventurous, and bright among us. These individuals are storytellers, entrepreneurs, athletes, designers, and everything else in between. It is my job as the host to take what they have each learned in their own lives and codify their knowledge so that you can use their lessons in your own life. Today's episode is sponsored by the Holocene Magazine. Our first issue is available now on the website, store, which you can find links below. Today, I am joined by none other than Evan Ruderman. Evan is an outdoor and commercial photographer based on the central coast of California. Raised under the notion that the best things in life aren't things, Evan uses a camera to capture and share life's intangible moments. His love of photography and outdoor pursuits has taken him all over the globe, from sailing adventures through the Arctic Circle to remote peaks in Patagonia. His adventures are fueled both by a desire to shoot captivating visuals as well as a longing to explore all the corners of the planet. Over the years, Evan has worked with a variety of clients to help them all tell their stories through powerful images, including La Sportiva, Billabong, Sony, Trek, Apple, Nissan, Red Bull, and many, many more. Now, we actually recorded this episode in Evan's backyard and wide range on a few different topics all over the place. And I can tell my grammar doesn't make sense at this point, so I'm just going to let the podcast play. I hope you enjoy.
Life is either an incredible adventure or it's nothing at all.
Evan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for coming out here. I'm excited to be a part of it.
Yeah, so we're sitting in your backyard right now. It's a lovely, sunny, slightly high overcast day in SLO.
Beautiful, sunny San Luis Obispo.
Oh, yeah. So I start every conversation off the same way by asking the question, what is the first thing you think about when you wake up in the morning?
That is a really good question. I would say the first thing that I think about in the morning is checking my phone, but I try to not check my phone for the first hour of the day. So I immediately, like, it's like when somebody tells you not to think about a white elephant, and then all you can think about is a white elephant. So I wake up and I'm like, don't check my phone. Then I think about my phone, and then I try and spend the next hour of the day not checking my phone. I usually wake up and go directly for a walk around the block just to get out of the house, away from my phone, get some fresh air, sunlight in my eyes, shower, coffee, breakfast, then let myself check my phone.
What is the desire to check the phone? Is it like a social interaction? Is it an email? Is it a work thing? Is it a distraction thing? What is the main driving force to grab it?
I'd say the main driving force is the stress of freelancing, wanting to check my email, see if anybody emailed me overnight with a giant project with a huge budget.
Yep.
I've been better about the social thing and not checking Instagram and such in the morning, but you know, these days I definitely am always like, oh, I want to see who emailed me and what's going on and what work is happening.
Sure. Yeah. Have you ever considered it like, so here's the dichotomy I always play with in my head, which this is the problem I create daily, which is that there are certain things like email, because I become work obsessed, that I want to limit myself from in the morning, right? But there are also certain things that I use my phone for. Like, I am a phone note taker. I also have a notebook, but like, they serve completely two different purposes for what I use it for. And also from like a to-do list perspective, from a thinking perspective, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, they're all
totally
heavily related and heavily syntaxed with each other. So like, at the end of the day, all I think about is this fact that like, I'd love to find some kind of filter. And I found that with downtime. You ever used downtime?
I've never used downtime.
Are you familiar with downtime?
Is that the one where when you open Instagram, it gives you a countdown to like think about if you really want to open it?
No, I think that's Instagram's tool. But there's literally a, if you're an iPhone user, which I assume most people listening to this are, no, sorry, Android users, and you go into screen time, there's a function called downtime.
Oh.
And what it allows you to do is it basically bricks your phone except for what apps you allow it to work. So for me, like, I used to have it run, I'm not kidding, from 9 p.m. to 9 a.m. each day. And it would brick not just the apps you don't want, but also the contacts you don't want.
Whoa.
So, and it works from a zero state. So it starts off assuming you want nothing, and then you add.
I love that.
So for example, for me, like, I unlock books so I can do audiobooks and still read. I unlock music because I still listen to a lot of music. I unlock notes, to-do lists, like productive things, creative things.
Yep.
Right? The camera, the workout app, my watch.
Yep.
And then in terms of contacts, it's like my girlfriend, my parents, my sister, my best friends, my grandma.
Yep.
Right? because and no one else I want to hear from. But the best thing about it is it literally, like, if you look at the text messages on the messages app, they just all say limited during downtime. You can't even see, like, it won't even show you a preview of the text. Like, it basically just puts your world in the bubble where, like, imagine you have a second phone that only has a certain number of apps and a certain number of contacts and can only do that thing. And if you need to turn it off, it can be turned off in a second.
I love that. That's funny because I was just talking with friends about how, you know, they have all these different phones now. I forget the name of them. Like,
one's called the Simple Phone.
Yeah, there's a few of them. And the whole idea is, the whole idea is you have a phone that's limited to, like, just calling and a few simple basic features. But
sure.
Me and my friends are like, yeah, but then, like, naturally you want, like, Google Maps, right? You need to be able to find where you're going. It's like, well, you also, like, want Spotify. Oh, well, you also want a camera. And then you're back to, like, and you don't want two phones.
Yeah, yeah.
But the fact that you can basically make that happen just on your iPhone is really smart.
And I'm surprised they don't advertise this.
Yeah.
You know, and but here's the thing too, right? If you were to open, let's just say, Instagram, for example, it shows you, like, kind of like you hit your time limit. It's like you have this blocked, but you can press a button to unlock and open it. So it's not like it's, like, bricked and you have to go into some setting and reverse it. Like, it kind of builds this, like, very fine opaque curtain of, like, hey, you blocked this off. Do you want to unlock it?
Yeah.
If you want to unlock it, is it for a minute, 15 minutes, or for the rest of the day? Right? And that's pretty nice. The
one
thing it doesn't do, which I really enjoy, is contacts.
Yeah.
So, like, if I'm trying to get work done, I'll just turn it on. I'll just go manually turn it on because, like, it's like, hey, I just make sure the people that need to contact me can get through.
Yep.
But, like, if downtime is turned on, I think they changed this feature because people requested it, but I think someone has to call me 3 times in a row to break through downtime. And twice is normal to break through. Downtime.
Yeah.
Three times is, like, someone's either manic
or
really needs me.
Yeah.
Right? And that's why I do 9 a.m. because, like, I think mornings are sacred, and even if I'm waking up at, like, 5 or 6, like, I like the idea of, like, getting so much done, and if I need to bring in other apps, like, open up Illustrator or open up something else, I will do it.
Yeah.
But also, I have this nice thing, but then when 9 o'clock starts, it's like, all right, the floodgates open.
Yeah.
And I said this precedent with people where it's like, if you need something from me, you call me. If it's immediate, you call me. Don't send me an email. A amount of times in the past, I used to get, like, urgent email, please open and fix this. And it's like,
2 days later.
2 days. And I'm like, look, but the only people that don't have my phone number are the people that wouldn't have those problems.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, it's a good solution.
So, yeah. Kind of what I think about. I only worry about, like, if someone were trying to contact me, if someone was hurt or injured, but I'm pretty sure they would keep calling me.
Yeah. So. Yeah, they get through, especially if you tell your friends and family, hey, sometimes you get a call 3 times, it'll get through.
Oh, for sure. But also, like, my friends and family are also let through on my contacts.
Yeah.
So that's also, like, a worst case disaster scenario. And, like, you can't live in that pessimistic mindset.
Yeah, 99.99% chance. It's just saving you distraction.
So you wake up outside. Are you, like, one of those people that is, you're going to go outside and walk regardless if it's raining or windy or sunny or cold or warm, right? It's like an unconditional walk.
Yes, it's unconditional, but I'm lucky that I live in San Luis Obispo, where I'd say, like, 95% of the time it's what it is right now, which is 75 and sunny. But
fuck you.
Yeah, if it's occasionally a little bit rainy or overcast, I'll still do it.
Oh,
yeah,
poor Evan.
Yeah.
Yeah, meanwhile, like, in upstate New York where the girlfriend is, the past week of weather, 8 inches of snow, 20 degrees. Next day, high of 56, low of 30. Next day, high of 50. Next day, high of 17.
Yeah.
Like literally, it makes no sense.
Yeah, I'm a baby living here in snow now. But I grew up on the East Coast, so I know I know what the cold is like.
Where'd you grow up?
New Hampshire.
We talked about this.
Yeah.
I know exactly where you grew up. You grew up in, like, that in-between of like, fun, where it's, like, not, like, deep mountain New Hampshire, but also, like, not, like, super urban New Hampshire.
Totally. Yeah. Hopkinton, New Hampshire, small town.
Yeah. New Hampshire's fun. Live free or die.
Exactly.
You went to kind of the opposite state mindset-wise, but I think California has a lot of, like, live free or die aspirations. It's just clouded with shitty politicians. So.
Yeah, I try to not think about that, but I find that, like, people are very similar. The vibe is very similar, especially where I live now in San Luis Obispo compared to New Hampshire, where people are relatively outdoorsy, relatively happy.
Yeah.
People are nice and kind, and it feels like people are kind of in a similar mindset here as there.
Yeah, I agree to that. I think, you know, I've long told my girlfriend and everyone else that, like, I plan on, like, spending a lot of time in California. And most people who don't spend time in California, the first thing they're like, what about the politics, what about the taxes? And I'm like, look, like, I plan on working to a point where, like, I don't have, that's not a convincing or deciding factor for me, part one. But part two is, like, it's a way of life and thinking that doesn't exist in so many other states.
and I've rarely found it. People are like, oh, but you can go to Austin. Like, I've spent time in Austin. It's not California.
Totally.
You know, Austin is Austin. Right. And like, you know, LA is LA, San Diego, San Diego, and OC is OC. Like, these three places could not be more different than each other. People are like, well, I hate LA. Okay, what part of LA do you hate? Right. Oh, just LA in general. Really? You've been to all of LA?
Yeah.
Right.
Totally.
Name me a town in LA that's not Santa Monica or Hollywood.
100%.
Right. And also, no, Malibu is not part of LA. Right. Malibu people say it is, but it's not, right? And then some people go like, oh, well, Culver City. I'm like, oh, cool. Have you been to Culver City? No. Okay. Awesome.
Yeah. I think it's as much or as little as you want to make it with that sort of stuff. If you want to focus every day on politics and headlines and taxes and this and that, it can eat you alive
for sure.
In any state. But if you just wake up and have a good day and don't put all your focus and attention into it, then things seem pretty good.
Well, I think so. I spend a lot of time on Twitter and or X, I should say, and it's the amount of people I see on there. They're like these. I call them fin twits because they're really or fin twats because of these people that like deeply believe that like every cent and dollar counts. And I'm like, it must be such a just depressing way to live. Like these people are finding freedom through this idea of like conserving as much money as possible, for what? Most of them are just conserving it for conservation's sake. They're not conserving it because they want to, like, you know, put a kid through school or, like, do something else. They're doing it because they want to just have this number in their account. And, like, the amount of people that I hear, like, oh, could never live in California because, you know, I don't want to lose that extra 8% every year. And I'm like, but what if you are happiest there? They're like, oh, it's not worth it. It's like, go fuck yourself.
Totally. One of my old coworkers, when I first moved here and was adjusting to taxes in California and whatever, and people, like you're saying, people love to comment on it, especially people who don't live here, and he would always just shrug and say it's the paradise tax. Mm-hmm. He'd be like, perfect, I hope these people complain about it because I love it here, my quality of life is so high, and I don't really care if there's a little extra taxes involved. And if people want to complain and talk shit about it and don't want to move here, then perfect.
I mean, there's always hidden cost to everything.
Totally.
Right? It's like people living in these brutal climates that don't have a refuge and feel like they have to go somewhere or drink more or do something or like go work out or get the sun exposure elsewhere. It's like, it would be still cheaper for you to just go live in the place you want to, you know, than flying there or creating an environment that felt like it.
Totally.
You know, like also the way I tell people is like, I know people that are like from warmer climates that refuse to live in like California, Arizona places, and they go live in the north and they're like heating their house to 75 degrees in the summer, in the wintertime. And I'm like, you're spending more on heating than you would on taxes in these states.
Totally. You know, it's a good practice to look at things holistically.
I at the end of the day, like, don't, I've never once made a decision because of the money, you know?
Yeah.
Even when I didn't have any money, it's something mm-hmm. from like a very young age, I forced myself to say, like, you know, I think a good example is like the first pro camera I ever bought, right? Like I had to put it on a credit card. I didn't know when I was going to fully pay it off. I know I could pay off like most of it, but it was like, do I take the safe route, get the basic one, or I get the one that has the features and the durability and the longevity that I want and over the long term be a better investment, but I may pay a couple $100 in interest the next few months because I can't pay it off. And like, I always was like, yes, that's the right thing. But some people are like, oh, that's crazy. You're like living outside of your means. And I don't know. I mean, like, do you know what I'm saying? Like it's just, Those who live within their means suffer from a lack of imagination. It's like an Oscar Wilde quote I always quote, to which like all the fin twat people are like, it's like, go fuck yourself. Don't say that. I'm like, no, seriously. It's like, you know, I think Casey Neistat says it well in one of his first vlogs. How he had a young kid, had no money, moved to New York City, maxed out his credit card to buy a movie film camera, the audio setup, and his first 2 months of rent.
Totally.
And he gave himself like 60 days. He's like, I don't have any money or credit line after this. And he's like, I have to make it work.
Yep.
And you make it work.
Yep. There's something to be said about that. Felt that way when I quit my job. And when you start freelancing, you're like, well, there's really no plan B. And so all there is to do from here is to figure out how to make it work and to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, usually when you put your back against the wall, you find a way out.
Always. Yeah. I mean, I left a cushy in terms of future design job in New York, making not a lot of money, so it wasn't cushy in that sense,
yep.
to go do freelancing. And I just wanted to break even with what I made before, but I made double the first year. And I was like, I had so much more free time and I had so much more fun.
Totally.
So through that lens, and I'm actually curious, there's a plane overhead of how, these are very good cardioid mics, so we'll see what it gets picked up. But I'm sure it sounds nice and vibrant and cool. So apologize for background noise, but to make it sound more live. Just to give people listening a viewpoint into the work you do now that might not be familiar with you, how would you describe the work you do now to your 8-year-old self?
To my 8-year-old self, I think, you know, the most basic one-liner is that I'm an outdoor and commercial photographer. I think a lot of people don't know what that necessarily means, yeah. And I probably wouldn't as an 8-year-old. So to an 8-year-old, I would just tell myself I'm a outdoor photographer, which just means I shoot photos and my work revolves around the outdoors.
Yeah. But I also think that that's not telling the full story, because like to usually get these images, you're going on a hell of an adventure from what I've seen.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely some adventuring and some outdoor experiences mixed in as well. I think my work and what pays the bills is the photos that I take, but to get those photos, a lot of the times you need a whole different skill set, which allows you to be in those places to shoot those photos.
Totally. So are there any recent like adventure stories that you feel like sharing that really stick out to you on a shoot? Something like it could be crazy, it could be cool, it could be something like your favorite. I don't really care.
That's a good question. I guess to start off the year, my first shoot in January was in Colorado for a development project, and they bought like a 4,000 acre ranch in Colorado, way up in the mountains. And they hired me and a team to go shoot photos and videos out there for them to use as promotional materials.
Cool.
But the only way to access any of that terrain out there was via snowmobile.
That's awesome.
So as part of the job, right, the job is shooting photos, but to do it, we were all loaded up on snowmobiles and spending 3 or 4 hours just ripping back way into the backcountry. And part of that too is, you know, from snowboarding, I have a lot of backcountry knowledge and snow safety knowledge. And so the whole team had that knowledge, and we had a safety crew, and
sick,
you know, to be out there shooting those photos, which in that scenario, shooting the photos is easy, and mitigating the risk and, you know, driving these snowmobiles over a little bit of sketchy terrain and getting out there.
Yeah.
That adventure is more so, is definitely a big part of the job as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's what the most cliche thing people will say. It's like, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. But like, I mean, I think that's the thing too, where it's like, I know more, just like you, know a ton of people that live in this world, and like, they just look like you're having so much fun while you're doing it.
Totally. Yeah, like today I shared a bunch of film photos on Instagram, and I was in Chile last fall for a commercial client shooting fancy photos on a fancy camera for them to use on their website and in marketing, and you know, everything's set up, we have models, but all the photos that I shared that I really like, I took on a little film camera in my pocket from the in-between moments when it's raining or snowing and we're waiting out shooting the weather and shooting the shit and meeting the locals and going around to, you know, the local bars and seeing kind of how the people down there actually live and experience life. And those in-between moments are always the most fun.
Yeah. And then I don't know, but like, I've used many of the fancy pro cameras you're alluding to, and and just for the audience record, like, we're not talking about like the $4,000 to $5,000 bodies. I'm talking about like a Phase One Hasselblad, the $150,000 camera bodies, right?
Yep.
Were you on a Phase One, or were you shooting Hasselblad?
No. I've used those for projects in the past with other photographers. I was just using my typical professional Sony gear.
Cool.
Like a Sony R5 or Sony A1, which for most of my jobs is what I use, and kind of the you know, quote unquote professional camera.
Yeah,
but
a
lot of the photos that I like are like the shitty $100 film cameras off eBay, totally, like that level. So there's a big disparity in how those cameras work.
Yeah, two of my close friends who are both photographers in their own right, I posted recently like a collection of film. I just got my film back from Richard's Photo Lab, shout out. From like, one is like, two of my friends' weddings were on there, 3 trips to my girlfriend were on there. It was like quality photos. Half the time I was drunk taking the photos, you know. You know how it goes, right? And so you know, from my perspective, it was really this eye-opening experience where like, the camera I was using was the first camera my parents ever gave to me, and it's a little Nikon Light Touch M autofocus film camera.
Sick.
And like, I had two friends reach out to me who like both shoot Leicas, and they were like, what camera is that? And I sent them an eBay link to like one that was bidding at like $44. One was like for sale at $63. Just put some Portra 400 in it, like as basic as it gets, and it shoots like a rocket. Like, it's awesome.
It's such a funny phenomenon. Yeah. Everybody wants a Leica, and everybody wants these fancy cameras. And I swear, if you had posted those photos and then hashtag like Leica Q2, people would be like,
wow, this
guy's shooting on Leica. He's
artsy.
So sick. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so I would one day like to buy a Leica, but not because I want to hashtag Leica or become the next Joe Greer or anyone like that, but just because, like, there is a certain allure I have to something that's fully mechanical. And, like, I don't make an analogy of a gun, but, like, you know, shooting with a Leica is like, you know, pumping a bolt action rifle. Like, it's something just feels like so innately totally carnal and great about doing it. So I would do it for that reason.
They're yeah, beautiful. And listen, I would take one too. I'd love to have yeah, one. I'd use it every day. I'd probably wear it.
From a color perspective, from a photo perspective, like, it's hard to beat the quality you get out of one.
Totally. Yeah. And again, I'd wear it around my neck all day so everybody yeah, knew I had one too. But, like, it's just such a funny social phenomenon, and just the way that trends work and how once people have something and share it, everybody wants it. And
totally,
it's funny to see that circle.
I'm just so glad we're out of, like, what I called the hyper toxic Instagram sphere of, like, 2016, 17, and 18. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Totally.
We're like, every influencer is buying a 1DX Mark II with their influencer money or daddy money, and they're buying crazy setups, and they're all flaunting these ridiculous cameras and doing the things, or wearing Leicas with, like, 1-inch straps that are basically like necklaces.
Yep.
You know exactly what I'm talking 100%. About. And, like, I'm so glad we're out of this, like,
totally,
signaling world of Instagram. I mean, people still do it, but, like,
it has its other pitfalls. But yeah, the new thing is everybody wants a Fuji, and they wear them like necklaces too, because they're, again, it's a beautiful camera.
It is. Are you talking about the newer Fujis, the older ones?
The new Fujis,
like the
X100V, yeah.
Yeah, the $10,000 medium format.
No, they're relatively inexpensive.
Got it. Well, which is the $10,000 one? Which is the one that's, like, you know what I'm talking about?
It's
like,
not from Fuji, but I know they make some nice ones.
It was a medium format one. Yeah. It's like the first pro level medium format yeah, camera that wasn't a Hasselblad.
Yeah. They have a lot of different models. I don't know all of them, but
I don't either. I stopped caring about gear a long time ago.
Yeah, people love the X100V, and it's funny. It looks a lot like a Leica. It's cheaper, but
sure. Everybody
wants one, so they sell for over market price. You know,
like that.
They're $1,200 new, and people are reselling them for $1,700.
Yeah,
and
go fuck yourself.
The more expensive they are, and the harder they are to get, the more people want them, which is just funny.
Yeah, I mean, so I've interviewed other famous pro photographers, and a lot of them get through it, and they're like, "You never asked me once about my gear." Or they're like, you asked a question about gear, but it wasn't about, like, what camera you're using. It was about, like, how to maintain gear in, like, very hard conditions, which is, like, far more fascinating of a question than, like, what
totally,
camera do you use,
yeah,
right? Which I'm sure is, like, you've seen, like, people ask these questions every time. It's their first question. Hi, which camera did you use to film this? Because I think some people still have this idea where they're like, And this was mostly around that time before then. It's really died down, and I think I'll explain why. But, like, if they could buy that camera, they could produce this as well.
Yeah. Right?
And what I'll tell people is, like, if you do not know how to use a camera and do not understand light, the more expensive the camera is, the shittier your photos will be.
Yeah, it's a good point for sure.
Because if you don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're manual and they're harder. Yeah, it's funny. Sure. People want to buy the best one because they think it's the yeah, best, but probably not the best for them.
No, I mean, I've been shooting on the Canon R5 mirrorless for 3 years now. And the Canon, like, R line, their new mirrorless lenses for about 4. And I switched from Sony for 2 reasons. One, because, like, I kept having durability issues with the Sonys. They just, and also, like, the way my hands just don't fit the Sony cameras, right? And, like, if they fit and they work, great, but, like, I picked up a Canon, I wasn't most enthused at first, and I just kept using it and I just liked it. And that's what yeah, I tell people. It's like, you can make great art with an iPhone.
Totally.
You know, and I think that's the point, is people stopped asking about gear from the point of, I need to get that to be that good, because so many people have started making such great content with iPhones or even less capable cameras. And the iPhone is a hell of a capable camera.
Totally.
So it's my favorite daily shooter at this point, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. At this point, really any camera you buy is going to be good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's the cliche saying, but whatever camera you have on you is the best camera
totally,
to have, which I definitely agree with.
I mean, for me recently, I've had a deep desire to get into more wildlife photography, because something as I get older about just, like, going to some place by yourself and sitting and just waiting and watching animals for a long time, like, sounds oddly appealing. I don't know if you feel the same way, but, like, it just sounds nice to go, like, you know, to the bush and sit with a ridiculously long dick length of a lens attached to your camera.
Totally.
And just take cool photos.
Spend some time waiting and thinking about life. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember talking to Paul Nicklin about, his experiences up in, like, when he was just starting out and he had to prove himself in such a different world back then. Mm-hmm. And he was like, how he was up in, like, Nunavut in, like, the northern parts of Canada,
yeah,
filming, doing polar bears, and he, like, had to carry a gun in case the polar bears turn on him. But also, like, he said he had like 400 rolls of film on a sled, yeah, and like had to take less food because he had to carry more film.
Yeah.
And also had to make sure it was warm, so he would like stuff him in a sleeping bag to like, well, you want to keep film cold, so it was great for that environment. But like, in order to put in your camera, it can't be too cold.
It'll
or
snap.
Else the film will snap.
Yeah.
So like, he had to like warm up the film canisters in his body, but couldn't make it too warm that he'd fuck with the.
Totally.
Yeah. And that, and then nowadays people are like, you know,
should I buy a Canon R4 or R5? You're going to be fine with either, I promise you.
It's like, I remember talking to my dad, because he's the one who got me into photography, and he like will upgrade cameras every 20 years, which I love and respect.
I like that.
Because he'll just, like, he had the first digital camera when it was out in like 2004.
Yep.
Like little, like, because he was an architect, so what he wanted to be able to do is go to a job site, take pictures, and send them to his clients. So he justified the $1,000 price tag at the time in,
yep,
2004, because he's like, look, this is great. And it made sense.
Yep.
And then he bought like one of the first like true Nikon DSLRs, because he had some old Nikon film lenses he wanted to still use. And then he had that for up until this past winter.
Yeah.
So he kept it for like 18, 16, 17 years. And he used
I love
it.
That.
And he loved it. But
totally.
Like, when he was looking at cameras, he was unsure of which direction to go, and I had given him my R5, so he's like, I like what Canon's doing. I'm sure Nikon makes an equivalent, but like, I've liked using yours, so I'm going to use it.
Yep.
And his reasoning was like, he went with, I forget which one he went with, but his thing was like, he uses it for now birding.
Yeah.
So he needed one. He was like, I want the fastest camera I can get that's not the like $6,000,
yep,
high-end camera. So
yep,
that was his driving force factor, where like the extra $1,000 over like the entry-level one was worth it to him, so
yep,
he get the speed.
Yeah.
Right?
Just depends on what you want to do with it.
Yeah, and I don't want this podcast to devolve down into a gear talk, because like, I'm sure some people are getting a lot of enjoyment out of this right now. I know you and I probably aren't getting the most, but it is fun to kind of, I love reminding people listening to this that like, it's not about the camera.
Yep.
It's not about the bike. Like, I used to be a professional cyclist. People are like, oh, I should get a faster bike and like,
yeah,
better suspension and better components. And like, yes, there's a level at which like it needs to operate efficiently.
Yeah.
It needs to be lightweight. It needs to be durable. But after that point in time, like, you can do a lot with a little.
Yeah.
You know?
It also depends if you're trying to race professionally, if you're trying to use,
sure,
it for fun, and if you're trying to,
sure,
mountain bike, if you're trying to commute. And with cameras, I think when I started shooting, I didn't really understand that or acknowledge that. I worked for a different photographer, Chris Burkhardt, and he was a Sony artisan, so he, mm-hmm, was always shooting Sony. So to me, like, the camera to use was Sony.
Yeah.
And anytime I was shooting anything, it made sense to do it on Sony because their cameras were the best. But then I started to realize, oh, there's kind of different cameras for different shoots that have a different look and different specialties,
totally,
and different,
yeah,
use cases. And so it's kind of like, you know, if you're buying a bike, what do you want the bike for?
Sure.
If you're buying a camera, what are you trying to do with it?
Exactly. And there's also the fun game of like, if there was no budget, what camera would you be shooting on? And like, I thought about this recently, and like, the fun thing to say would be like, get a Phase One, get like a insane medium,
yeah,
format, crazy camera. But in the day, like, I don't think it would change. I think I would just shoot film more, because film is so expensive. I would,
yeah,
probably just shoot mostly film.
Yeah.
And then just like literally have like a weekly drop where I was sending 10 to 15 rolls to a film. And like, and also figuring out, because like, that's the thing about film, and my mind is like, the next frontier for me personally is like, it's not shooting the film, it's not developing the film. Like, I learned that at a very young age. It's understanding what to tell the lab to do when processing the film to get the color and,
yep,
the effects that I'm looking for. And that's like the next frontier. That's a lot of trial and error. It's,
yeah,
just trial and error, you know?
Yeah, and a lot of different quality between film labs. Took me a while to learn that too.
Totally.
Like, when I first started shooting film, I sent it all to the first lab I found or other,
mm-hmm,
friends were sending it to, and I just thought that that's what film looked like. And then I sent a roll to a different lab from the same camera, same thing, and I'm like, oh, this looks way better. Started to realize that there's, yeah, different film labs can do a better or worse job than
others.
It's
not just the lab, it's the way they process the film. It's the scanner they're using.
Yeah.
Like this Noritsu, Fujitsu.
Yeah, totally.
These are all these Japanese,
yeah,
film scanners that do it. I mean, I'm partial to Richard's Photo Lab. I don't know who you use.
I've used both. I've used the darkroom for a long time,
yeah,
and
yeah,
Negative Lab.
Yeah, and there's Nice Films Film Club or something. I don't know. I mean, at the end of the day, like, the point I'm making, and I think I'm diving deep into this gear conversation because I've resisted it with every single other photographer I've ever interviewed, and it's because people keep asking, they're like, I'd like to know more about the gear people are using, and I'm like, you can Google it.
Yeah.
And then part two is like, from a practical standpoint, it's fascinating though. So kind of getting on that hill with you and asking that question is like, when you're out in these difficult conditions, like take, Colorado's an example because it's probably fucking freezing.
Yeah.
Obviously the camera batteries are going to last a lot shorter there. So what was your guys' like mitigation? That was just hand warmers or having extra battery packs always heated up or?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy how good cameras are these days for the most part in terms of like really harsh conditions. Like they're getting pelted with snow and ice and all that. They're fine. Really, the biggest concern is batteries. But if you just keep them in your chest pocket, like chest pocket on the layer closest to your skin or closest layer to your skin that has a pocket, your body heat keeps them warm.
Yeah.
But duct taping them with some gaff taping them with some hand warmers works great too. Nice. But other than that, like being way out there, it's pretty amazing how good gear is. And you can, you know, mine was strapped down to the sled, like my camera pack, and bouncing around, they do fine. You know, they're mirrorless. When you take them out and it's snowing on them or hailing or raining, they're totally fine. They're weather sealed. You know, obviously you want to keep the glass clean and unscratched. I always shoot through filters, most of the time polarizer filters. And so if they do, you know, get covered in snow, you can wipe them off or take the filter off. And
or if you smash blow it, like I've done many times, you just replace it.
Exactly. And the biggest thing when it's really snowing and really cold or raining is just switching lenses and making sure you're not getting anything, snow in the element of the lens or the camera.
Yeah. That's like, that's literally the only hard thing.
And I've been in gnarly situations in Japan where it's snowing so hard, like it doesn't even feel real. Like it's like a movie where it's like, it's literally snowing sideways and the snowflakes are like as big as your hand.
Yeah.
And I've changed lenses and gotten snow on the sensor. And once that happens, it's just game over. Yeah. You're just like, there's no coming back until you bring that thing inside and let it
dry
out and clean. And that's the beauty of keeping a second camera body with you.
Oh, I guess that actually brings up a good question. So a lot of professionals, especially outdoor photographers, use polarizers. Yeah. I don't think the average person knows what a polarizer is or why it's used. Do you want to go into that?
Yeah, they do two different things. The biggest thing and the biggest reason I use them is that they cut reflections. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times if you're shooting somewhere where there's windows or glass, it's going to cut down reflection and also glare. So whether it's windows, same thing when you're shooting anything with water. Just like wearing polarized sunglasses, it lets you kind of see through the water and takes away that kind of glimmer and white shine on the top of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And then it does the same with the sky, which is just the sky maybe doesn't look like it the same way it looks like the top of a lake does, but there's clouds and moisture in the sky. And when you when you engage the polarizer, it's going to make the sky look a lot more vivid and colorful.
You know, it also interacts with color too, right?
Yes. So, yes.
And like, I remember I went all through college using a pretty simple, like one of the base level Nikons I saved up to buy. And then I decided towards the end of college, I was going to buy like one of the lower tier cameras that are like towards the pro range. I bought my first polarizer and I was like, and I was living in Arizona, so I'm just used to like bright ass fucking everything. And the first time I shot with it, I was like, what have I been missing the past while? And
totally.
I've always used one since.
Yeah. makes colors pop. It makes everything look a little more vivid and beautiful.
Yeah.
But I will say the biggest thing is, and I can be cheap sometime and try and cut corners and save money and little things, but with filters, it's funny because people buy expensive cameras and expensive lenses and then put a cheap filter on the end.
Nice filter.
And a polarizer is one of those things where a good polarizer makes your photos better.
Yeah.
A bad polarizer makes your photos like 100 times worse.
Yeah.
And I forgot that, but I did a shoot recently and I borrowed a polarizer I was borrowing a different lens, so I didn't have the right thread polarizer. I used a different one, and I looked at the first photo I shot on it, and I was like, I'm throwing this thing in the trash. Like, these are just, like, the worst colors I've seen, and it's impossible. Like, it's never good to rely on fixing something in post, but when a polarizer messes up your colors, it's really difficult to write that later on, and so get a good one if you're going to get one.
Do you have any recommendations, people out there listening that have never tried them before?
I really like the Polar Pro ones.
I
religiously use theirs.
Yeah. Do you have like the magnetic ones? Those are cool.
I haven't actually used those.
Yeah.
Filters are, I mean, like I'm saying, because you literally shoot all your photos through them. They're expensive. And I've had just the standard ones for a while. Those are really good. And then I always trust Hoya. But it's the same thing. You know, if you search Hoya CPL, there's going to be like six different price ranges. And you maybe don't need to get the highest tier, but if you get the cheap ones, $30, $40, they're going to be pretty rough.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is like a good polarizer, especially for a wide, like my Canon 28 to 70 f2 lens has like a 95 millimeter thread size,
yep.
and that's like a $300 Polaroid.
Yeah, they're huge.
and people are like, oh, you can get the cheap one. And I remember same thing. I bought a cheap one time, and I was like, why do these photos look so shit?
Yeah.
Also, to this last point on like gear and cameras, you know, some people look, I think Chris Burkhardt's a great example of his work, where people are like, how do you make the photos look that way? I'm like, how does he edit them? I'm like, no, there's just this like, something just stands out. I'm like, it's a polarizer. Like,
yeah.
Almost always, every single time. People are like, yeah, but this person does do it. It's a polarizer.
Yeah.
It's polarizer.
It is fine.
Yeah, yeah. So polarizer, if you're looking for that like last thing, like what's missing from this camera, it's not your editing ability. It's not Lightroom. It's not a new lens. It's most likely a polarizer.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good thing to keep
it's,
on.
It's most likely a polarizer.
And like I was saying, I just keep mine on because you can, there's, you know, circular polarizers can be engaged or disengaged. They spin around. Yeah. And so if I don't want it, I just, a lot of time I spin it to not be engaged, but it's just a little protection on the end of the lens too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right now I'm one of my lenses I have like just floating around my car. Cause I'll throw it on and be like, oh, I wanted this one is like the filter broke and I haven't replaced it. So I'm just like out there. I'm surprised I haven't scratched the main element yet, but I'm just looking at brush. I'm like, I'm sure I passed a bazillion camera shops along the California coast.
Totally.
But I'm just like, I actually should probably, this reminded me, I should go.
There's one here in town, but it's funny, especially in today's day and age where people love imperfections in photos and like that, the whole like crystal clear look is almost a thing of the past because it was so easy and attainable. And now people like to make things interesting and artsy.
Mm-hmm.
It's really funny. I was on a shoot with Alex Stroll a few months ago and I was borrowing, I usually shoot Sony, but when I work with him, I shoot Canon. Mm-hmm. I borrowed one of his lenses and it was all scratched up. And I was at first I was worried I did it, and then I realized it definitely wasn't me. And so I went over to him. I'm like, hey, I'm just telling you, this thing's like super scratched, and it wasn't like that, I swear. And he's like, oh yeah, like it's been like that for months. Like I love the way it looks, which I thought was hilarious because like we're saying, people stress so much over gear and over all these imperfections, and then we have like one of the world's leading photographers whose lens on his main lens is like scratched to shit, and he's like, I love it. It makes it all these lens flares and imperfections.
I mean, look at you know, most of the film photographers I know, their like favorite lenses look like they went to war, and some of them
exactly
actually did.
Yeah.
You know? But also from a lens perspective, like even the thickest scratch is not going to show up because of how focal lengths work, as you know well.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, if anyone's looking for a fun mindfuck of a physics thing, like optics, fascinating.
I know. I wish my brain could understand it more, but there's a reason I'm a photographer and not a scientist. And like when I start to look at those diagrams of the insides of lenses, I'm like, wow, somebody way smarter than me created this thing.
Totally. I mean, it's all math at the end of the day.
Yeah.
It's basic. It's not, I said it's basic geometry. It's not basic geometry, but like it is geometry.
Yeah.
Right. And there is a mathematical process to follow. And I remember there was an optics and lasers class at my school. Cause I started engineering. This is like a astrophysics in the astros department. They had an optics and lasers class. And all my friends who are in that program, some of the smartest people I know now, like running teams at SpaceX, they were like, this is the hardest fucking class I've ever taken in my entire life. Cause they're like, you know, building on these tables, building lasers from scratch, and then also building with like prisms and lenses and like amplifying and moving. And I'm just like, that sounds crazy.
Totally. It's a different world.
A different world.
Same with just camera tech in general, you know, when they released the new Sony A9 III and it has 120 frames per second global shutter and all this stuff, like some smart people are making these cameras.
Who needs 120 frames per second? Can we talk about that? Like I love when, here's my favorite. You show up the tunnel view in Yosemite, and I call it the dad bod Olympics, because you have these guys that are in terrible shape, mostly white or Asian men. I'm not making this about race. It's just like you know exactly the stereotype I'm talking about, and they pull out these like $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 setups to take like one photo of the sunset that still looks like ass. and I love it so much because like they're shooting like one photo every 3 seconds with a camera that's meant to like shoot Olympic athletes or like Nat Geo creatures in the bush or like be used in the space station.
Totally.
And I just don't. So people always ask me like, because I'm like, my type of work does not lend itself to need a high-end camera, but there's two things I will pay the money for. One is sensor quality.
Yep.
Right? Second is durability.
Yep.
That's it. That's where the line stops. I don't care how fast it is. I don't care how slow it is. Like, the kind of work I shoot, I'm not ever shooting, like, the Olympics.
Totally.
And if I ever decided one day I'm like, I'm going to go be a photographer in Africa and shoot animals, like, I would get the camera for that.
Totally.
It's not the camera I have now.
Like we were saying before, it's like riding a bike. You know, what are you trying to do with it?
Yeah. It's like if you want to enter into a downhill mountain biking race, you're not going to bring a road bike to that race.
Exactly.
Like, in that case, it is about the bike.
Yes.
Right? You will die. Yeah. It's going to be very uncomfortable when you crash, and that fork probably splinters after dropping a couple feet.
Totally.
I don't recommend. carbon shards in the arm is one of the most painful things. I highly don't recommend that anyone try that. So on this journey that you've had recently from working with, you know, kind of full time with a photographer to working with other photographers, like what has been one of like the biggest things you've noticed in terms of like a change of interest and lifestyle and value?
It's a good question. Something I think about a lot, probably daily as I've made this transition. It's pretty crazy. Time flies, but it feels like I just made this transition yesterday, but somehow we're coming up on a year and a half. But I would say, you know, before I worked for a different photographer, for Chris Burkhard, and at his studio with six other people, and one thing that I didn't fully, I don't want to say understand, because I just didn't fully appreciate, was how important the collaborative process is. Mm-hmm. And now that I work on my own as a freelance photographer in an office in my house solo, how important that collaboration is and how helpful it is for you and for other people, and how far it can take projects. Like when I'm trying to concept something on my own and mm-hmm. think about what I want to do and where I want to shoot and making all these plans and doing all these things alone, compared to like if I happen to go to a coffee shop that day and there's someone else there and they're like, what are you working on? And I start explaining to them and then, oh, you should do this. Oh, I should do this. Oh, I should do this. I'm like, wow, I just got so much further than I would have alone.
Yeah.
And you know, now too, I think there's a trend where anytime I'm getting hit up to shoot photos, whatever the project is, they also want video, right? So now I'm like, okay, I need to work with somebody on video. Mm-hmm. And then usually now once you have a photographer and a videographer and you're working with a client and they have money to put together a shoot, especially the shoots I'm shooting now,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of details that need to be taken care of. Yeah. And then you need a producer.
Yep.
And then you need this and that, you know? And so
a DP and an editor, and assistant editor and assistant colorist. And
exactly. So I think I was leaving the studio like, I'm so stoked. I'm going to go freelance and do this on my own and have so much freedom. And now I'm a year and a half into it. I'm like, okay, I think there's definitely something to be said about having a team.
Yeah.
And like,
for sure.
Whether that's a formal photo studio or whether that's just like people that you work with consistently, quote unquote tribe. I like the tribe collective, you know, but
I use tribe with my team. So
yeah, there's definitely something to be said about working with others and having some sort of team.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think in media, and I'm sure you've had projects where you can just do it yourself, right? And that's mm-hmm. like, that's fun. But also sometimes having a crew to make that creative and push that extra limit. I mean, I've had you obviously spent more time doing this, but like one of my best friends, one of his best friends is Aaron Brimhall, the mm-hmm. mostly automotive photographer in yep. Utah. So I spent a lot of time with him on shoots.
Yeah.
And I remember there's this one shoot where we had a Ford GT, a beautiful one in perfect condition, out in the Bonneville Salt Flats. And it was me, my friend, Aaron, Aaron's wife, his kids, and then Peter McKinnon was just there.
Yeah.
And I was just like hanging out. And like, to me, it was cool. But like, the thing about Peter, which is interesting, is like he was filming a behind the scenes vlog.
Yeah.
On the thing. And like, he didn't care that I was there, not in a negative way. He was just like focused on his work. And
yeah.
I like really appreciated that. He was just like, wasn't being rude. He was just like, and he was very talkative and friendly.
Totally.
He was just like, I'm here to do the thing.
Yeah.
And he didn't even have to say it. Cause like you knew that he was just about the mission.
Yeah.
You know? And I really appreciated that. But like a lot of people in similar ranks as him, and he had a really interesting rise because I think he was a lesser known photographer that I think had really good chops, and then through his YouTube video kind of blew up. YouTube channel, right?
Yeah.
And because he was the first photographer that I think was willing to be like, I'm gonna open the kimono, so to speak, and show all the secrets that is
totally.
Like very common knowledge to the Burkhards and the Strolls of the world that like most people just need to go in and do it. And
totally.
I think that made him kind of a man of the people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's gonna grow a following really quickly.
Totally.
You know? So well,
it's funny.
I respect that.
Yeah, it's funny what you're saying about him not really talking and or not talking to you all that much because he was working. And something I've noticed is a lot of times when I was working with other photographers and I was the assistant, I would, you know, they'd be maybe making a plan or setting something up and I would be kind of chatting with, because these things are always, there's always a group of people and there's talent or athlete and like, you know,
social,
you want
to, needs to be social.
You want to make small talk and be social. You're not just going to like let it be silent and weird. You're trying to keep a good vibe going.
Sure.
And now I do these photo shoots on my own. And like I was saying, these first shoots I did when I started freelancing, a lot of times it was just me shooting and then I had talent, models, athletes, whatever. And they would always want to be talking and socializing and chatting. And in my brain, I'm trying to like plan out the shot and like think about the things sunset next, and think about where we're going to get dinner after the shoot, because you don't want to. And also trying to talk. And now I'm at a point where I'm like, from any shoot on, I think I need to bring an assistant, not only for the photo help, but also because I need to have somebody who can chat and hang while I take a few steps away and start planning.
And if you need a second hand, you have a second hand.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But and the second hand thing's super important. But from just a social aspect, it's like it's really hard to be the guy that's socializing and talking and having fun and thinking logistically and thinking about artistically about the shots and planning and everything. And there's moments where your brain's just breaking because you're like trying to have a nice conversation, but you're like out of the corner of your eye, you're like looking at like the mountain range to see where the sun's gonna set.
Shut up for a second.
Yeah, exactly. And there's times you're just like, I'm sorry, I can't talk. I gotta just figure this out. Yeah. But yeah, it's helpful to have somebody else around to help take that weight.
And that's why I have so much respect for some of these photographers that do a lot of solo work. And you'd expect there to be a whole production. There's just one dude.
Yep.
Or one chick.
Totally.
You know, I think a mutual friend, I'm sure you've known him or known him, but Ty Ravel. He does a lot of snow sports.
I've actually never met him, but I follow him and we've chatted a little bit online. Yeah. But his work is incredible.
And he's a one-man show.
Like, yeah.
He's doing all that crazy backcountry shit as a one-man show, which is like insane.
The work he puts out is some of my favorite work right now, and it's because, I mean, the photos he takes are amazing.
It's unique,
And it's really good, and a lot of people do it, and it's unique, but he also shoots all this behind the scenes stuff and this kind of, like we're saying, the in between stuff. And he still manages to post all of that too, which not only from a photo perspective, but just shout out to him, because as somebody who's been on those shoots, your time is so few and far between and you're so busy. And the fact that he takes time
to do
I know the process to airdrop from the camera to your phone, sort through them, share them as stories, might sound simple, but when you have like 1,000 other things and it's 1 a.m., it's really fucking impressive that he does it.
No, like, but once people get in that, mindscape, then I think there kind of unlocks something new. I mean, so I guess what's your camera story? Like, when did you pick up a camera? Like, what got you into it? Like, who inspired you? You know,
totally. I guess it all depends how far you want to go back. But like I was saying,
OG. Like, what made you love photography?
Yeah, so I grew up in New Hampshire, like I was saying, in a small town, not much to do except play outside. There were no like downtown or really anything to do. So naturally me and all my friends played outside, but I have an older brother, 3 years older. So I spent a lot of time with him and his friends, and they were all better at these sports than me. Like, we were big park skiers and snowboarders.
Sure.
Because the mountains
aren't
big enough.
That's a New Hampshire thing.
Yeah, there's no powder.
That's a very New Hampshire thing.
There's no powder and the mountains aren't very big.
We ski park.
So we ski park.
Or ravines.
And then, and naturally they were better than I was. So somehow it was like, you know, somebody's got to shoot some photos or videos of this. And like, I'm the youngest and the worst. So they put a camera in my hand, which is classic.
Fuck yeah.
And then I started to really like it and shoot some more photos for fun. And whenever we did stuff like that, I'd go shoot photos. And then eventually there was a photo class in my high school, but I hadn't heard good things, but there was one math teacher who outside of school was a landscape photographer, like as a side gig. And he occasionally would do independent studies with kids, but he was a little particular. So I like shot some landscape photos, and eventually I printed out all my photos and brought them to him and showed him. I was like, I want to do an independent study. And I looked through everything. He's like, all right, yeah, we could do this next semester. Cool. So he's the first person who like really taught me.
And this was high school? Do you remember
this was
high school?
I want to say this was my sophomore year of high school.
Cool. So you're like 16?
I was like 16. Cool. My first ever meeting with him, like the first day with him, because I had a Canon T2i, which I bought on eBay.
Fuck yeah.
Like you were saying.
Here's the thing. Every single photographer I know in our generation started with the T2i.
100%.
It's awesome. It is like the OG. It's like the origin story.
I gave it to my brother to borrow, but I told him, I'm like, don't ever give this away. Don't ever throw this out. Don't ever sell this on eBay because you don't think I want it.
This is the Genesis camera.
This is my first camera and I want this.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll never forget the first day of my independent study. I showed up to his math room and he had a piece of like cardboard, and on one side it was black and on one side it was white. And at this point I'm shooting full auto. So he's like, take a photo of each side. So I took a photo of the front side and I took a photo of the back side. And he's like, now show me. And they were each gray because he was explaining to me that your camera meters to zero. And I never like, thought I had just used auto and taking a photo of things I thought were pretty. And I was like, the biggest mind fuck was that this camera was making black gray and was making white gray. And he's like, I'm going to teach you how to shoot in manual.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa. So he taught me how to shoot in manual. He was super cool. He'd like on the weekends, he'd go shoot landscapes and he'd invite me. So like my sophomore year of high school, I was in this phase where I'd like wake up at 5 a.m. to go shoot waterfalls, like all like slow shutter waterfalls.
Yeah.
And I'd meet this math teacher like way in the middle of nowhere. His name was Lawrence Bickford. He was a homie. So I got really into it then and I shot photos through high school. And then I moved to Michigan. I went to college at University of Michigan. Kind of stopped shooting. Did the classic college thing. I studied a lot and partied a lot. And I lived in Michigan, so I didn't shoot many photos.
Mm-hmm.
And then my junior year, I studied abroad in Chile. So I went to Chile for 6 months.
Nice.
And that kind of snapped me back into it because I was backpacking and surfing and traveling. Sure. And yeah. I brought my trusty T2i and was shooting all these photos and loved it. And was shooting, it was just an amazing place to be shooting photos.
No,
and
totally.
I was really excited about what I was shooting and kind of that excitement of like go on a weekend trip, shoot a bunch of photos, come home, like go to a coffee shop in Chile and be editing these photos and sharing them and like on such a high, like psyching. And you know, that junior year is kind of the first time where people start to ask you like, what are you going to do after college? Like, what do you want to be?
Who do you want to become?
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm all stressed and I just remember being down there and being like, this is awesome. But like, I don't know what that really means.
Yeah.
And then I returned home, spring semester, I returned home and I had a marketing internship in Boston, junior year summer going into senior year.
Mm-hmm.
And I just hated it.
Oh,
just hated it. I'm like, oh God, you know, I thought marketing would be fun, but this isn't fun. I'm working for like a sour cream brand. Like, I don't know what to do. And I remember then kind of out of boredom, I was scrolling around. I was on Chris Burkhardt's website, realized he had an internship. I'm like, that'd be cool. Go back to college, do my senior year. You know, now everybody's accepting job offers and going to New York City and
I'm
doing this.
I'm going to Goldman and
exactly.
I'm going to PwC.
I'm going to Goldman.
Like,
where are you going?
I'm going to go fuck yourself.
Like, I don't know. And so kind of by the end of college, I was like, all right, I'm just going to move back to South America and teach English. But also for shits, I'll apply for this internship with Chris Burkhardt, which is hilarious because the internship started before I even graduated. But I was just like, I'm not going to get this internship. But I applied and did an interview and I got the internship. And they're like, cool, we need you here May 1st. I'm like, I don't graduate till May 7th, but I can be either May 8th. So I graduated, basically came straight to California. I'd never been here to San Luis Obispo. Didn't really know anything about the area, but it was a 4 month internship. So I was like, I'll do 4 months and then I'll figure out my life after that.
Yeah.
And then 4 months turned into like, hey, do you want to do a second internship? I was like, sure.
Was he paying you that time?
Yes.
Good.
And
the first one's unpaid, right?
The first one was unpaid. So I did 3 days a week unpaid.
Which I personally have a huge like ethical problem with that, but continue.
We can speak more about that. But I did 3 days with him and then 4 days at a sandwich shop slinging sandwiches.
Nice.
And then the second one was paid. And then during the second one, somebody quit, so it opened up a position, and I was kind of right place, right time.
Cool.
So then that turned into right around 4 years with Chris, and then a year and a half of freelancing.
What year did you graduate Michigan?
I graduated 2019.
Cool. So is it Russell who left?
Russell was gone. It was actually two people. Ryan Hill left, Wes, and Matt Foley left.
Got it. Yep.
And I had heard some rumblings from them that they might leave, so I also...
They're both still freelancers. They're doing their own thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it was a good place for me... Good time for me, and I knew that
Ryan's
maybe
fascinating. Yeah,
yeah. Ryan's a really, really talented human.
Yeah,
he lives a few blocks away. I go over there for coffee all the time.
Cool.
Yeah,
I've never met him.
It's that same thing of working solo. Like,
sure.
One day he came over here to drop off camera. Like, we all borrow stuff from each other.
Sure.
And we were like, each had a coffee, and we're talking and frothing about this. And he's like, all right, I gotta go back and like do some work. I was like, dude, like that was so nice. Like, we just talked about all this stuff for like an hour, and he's like, dude, I live like three blocks away. We should do this all the time. And so now a lot of times I'll like make coffee and text him and be like, let's drink coffee and froth for 30 minutes, chat about what we're doing, whatever, and then come home, which is really nice.
That's such a California word, froth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I learned that from those guys. I had to learn a whole new dialect when I moved here.
The California surfer language is fascinating and I love it. And I've definitely stolen some, and I think there's among cyclists, which I knew before I knew like surfers, it's like there's a lot of similar, like kook slam is like one of those terms that like only exists in surfing and cycling, you know, and people outside are like, what the fuck's a kook slam? Just Google it.
Yeah. No, I love froth. I love coffee froth because I love coffee and I drink coffee all the time.
Sure.
And I love...
It's kind of a staple cliche photographer thing.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, yeah. 100%. But I love like drinking a cup of coffee and they're drinking their coffee and you're just getting all psyched in the morning. Yeah. Oh, I'm going to do this. Oh, I'm going to edit this. Exactly. And then you're like, all right, that was awesome. Break. I'm going home. Now I'm all fired up.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because like Peter McKinnon used to start his videos by showing his like perfect drip setup that he's making his coffee. Being of every single video, people that weren't in photography be like, what the fuck is this shit? Every other like photography dude out there is just like trying not to jack off in the ASMR of like this photographer making coffee and then talking about photography. And that's like, that's the whole world.
It's such a funny cliche because it's so real. And when I like go to a coffee shop and get a cortado and edit photos, I'm like, yeah. Wow, I am like,
why am I the way I am?
Yeah, yeah. With like a little beanie on too. I'm like, oh man, well, look how far I've come.
I once had a friend who I was with a couple of photographer friends, and he was just not aware of that world.
Yeah.
And he's like, so why do you guys all like go into coffee shops and editing work? And then they were like, where else would you edit work? He's like, your home. You can make coffee at home. And there was to them, it was like preposterous thing they'd ever heard. They're like, why would we ever do that?
Totally. My brother always calls me. He's like, what are you doing? I'm like, we're going to a coffee shop. He's like, didn't you just move into a house and you like have an office? And I'm like, I know, but it's not the same as the coffee shop.
I am like your brother. I'm the person where like, I have a heavy respect and enjoy the coffee shop, but I'll always remember my office. Always.
It's funny because
I can't scream.
It's funny that being freelance has been such an interesting process of learning about myself and my like productivity habits.
Sure.
But I love the social aspect of a coffee shop. Like I like to wake up in the morning and like put on a reasonable clothes and walk to a coffee shop and get the social buzz. But then when it's time to like actually do something, I hate the distraction and all the background noise. So I'm like, I go to a coffee shop to like
warm up and
like socialize. I usually try and text a buddy or two, say hi to people. And then I'm like, cool, I've done this for an hour. Like, I'm going to go home and close the door and like actually like crank out some edits and crank out some important work.
Yeah.
But it's a balance.
Well, also because Slow isn't the biggest city, but it's also not small. But I feel like there's like tight communities at local coffee shops here, right? Like you see the same people over and over again.
Yeah, 100%. I have two coffee shops. One of them, when I want to be social, I know.
You can plug them. What are they?
I know the owners. It's Field Day.
Okay.
And if I go there, I'm
That's a well-known coffee shop. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. If I go there, I'm 100% running into people I know
and
saying hi and being social.
Sure.
But there's a second coffee shop, which I won't shout out.
Cool.
And that's where I go when I don't want to talk to anyone.
Got it. So you're not shouting
out. Other side of town. And I like put my head down and like order a coffee quickly and sit down. I'm like intentionally not like socializing and meeting people there because I like to have
just the don't option. Fucking talk to me exactly. kind of vibe. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure. I used to be a heavy, heavy coffee drinker.
Yeah.
Like I think most. And then I had to get some health testing done back in like 2015, 16, 17. And at one point I had to give caffeine for like 3 or 4 months. Wow. So long enough to like the half-life dies and like that dependency dies. And then I remember like just craving that entire time. Probably it was definitely the caffeine at first. It was the taste of coffee.
Yeah.
But then I had like my normal, which is like I was a big cappuccino guy. And like a proper like California well done frothy whole milk cap, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right? Probably 2 or 3 shots. I like my caffeine. I remember doing it, and I remember like being like, "Oh God, this is fucking awful."
Yeah.
Right. And literally from that day, something like 6-5 years, I have not touched caffeine.
It's impressive.
Like in any and like no soda, no Red Bull, no caffeine, no tea even. Like I'll do herbal teas.
Yeah.
I won't even have decaf coffee. And here's the thing. To me, it's just like it's a caffeine thing. And I am one of my projects in the next few years is to make a coffee that tastes like it's like the most optimized taste of coffee without the caffeine.
Yeah.
To like create this opposite world. Because there are plenty of people like me who like my girlfriend has a beautiful espresso machine and I smell it every morning and I'm just like, oh fuck, I want that, but like I don't want the caffeine. And like in a heartbeat I would do it again without the caffeine. And like people are like, oh, you can do decaf, and decaf actually has a fair amount of caffeine. People don't realize, like there's a great book I'll plug, Michael Pollan's This Is Your Mind on Plants.
Yep.
You know it?
Yeah.
And so like caffeine in my mind is like one of the largest unrestricted, unscheduled, unmoderated drugs in the world that we freely and openly abuse, that causes so many problems. Also a lot of good things, but like, look, I'm not here to shit on caffeine. All I'm saying is like, I personally would love, and I think there is a strong future market for like, imagine like the highest quality espresso bean you can find, but completely free of caffeine.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. On the coffee note, I've done the same. You know, I love the productivity hacks and all the wellness and different things.
Sure.
And I did a stint with no coffee a few years ago. And I remember like 100% I was better off from an energy standpoint. Like I didn't get the afternoon crash.
No crash. Wake up when you want to, go to bed when you want to.
I couldn't deny it. It was night and day, but I just love coffee way too much. Yeah. It's a ritual. But like you're saying, if you could make a good one, you know, what you're saying reminded me of like, now they have really good non-alcoholic beer.
Yeah.
And I was with my brother in Tahoe, and we were talking about how great they are, because the older I get, the more I get invited to social stuff. Hey, let's grab a beer. Hey, come over. Last night I went to a pizza night at a friend's house.
Let's share a bottle of wine.
Let's have a beer.
Let's
and I'm
get
like,
drunk.
I love the taste of beer. I don't want to drink a beer like 4 or 5 nights a week just because I'm being social. And mm-hmm. the non-alcoholic beers are like a great remedy. If they made that for coffee, I'd probably have one each afternoon. So
yeah, I think it's possible. The real thing is like the caffeine molecule is binded inside of the coffee bean. So using moderate, like I want to create a way to remove the caffeine from the coffee bean without changing the flavor or the texture of the coffee bean. If you're grinding the coffee, there's an easy way to filter out the caffeine. You can use Swiss Re, you can use existing machines.
Huh.
The problem is, as you know, right? Like the best coffee comes from beans that were ground literally as soon as you're roasting it, right? So
yep.
I think from my perspective is maybe there's a way to do it where you can process it and then immediately remove all aeration from it mm-hmm. to preserve it.
Yeah.
I'm interested in it from a personal perspective. Yeah. Because I think there'd be a lot of people interested. And I think it would be the competitor to like the Athletic Beer Co. The what's that really good company that's making a lot of awesome like alcohol-free spirits. They're using a lot, I forget the name, but it's like this really, it's really beautiful packaging. And
yep.
they like basically allows you to make any martini. And look, that's the thing is I've definitely drank more since I gave up caffeine.
Yep.
Right. So like, I'm not saying it's perfect and like,
totally.
I'm not saying alcohol is less bad than caffeine. Cause like everything is bad. Everything's good in totally. Moderation, right?
Yeah.
Put it that way. But like, I definitely drink too much right now and I'm trying to like bring that down. But to me, it's just like, it's like sugar, caffeine and alcohol.
Yeah.
Are like the three horsemen that modern society deals with.
Totally.
And the people that abuse all three have the worst health problems, right? I would argue that I abused one. I abuse alcohol. I wouldn't say I abuse alcohol. I'm just saying like I drink what I consider to be a normal amount, but mm-hmm. someone who doesn't drink would be a lot.
Yep.
At the end of the day, it's like it's a social thing.
Yeah.
And also like I work best in a bar. Like if you were to pick like a outside of a library, like a place that's serving food or drinks, like drinks. And because like for me, there's like, sometimes the work I can get done while drinking a bottle of champagne, I can never get close to doing sober.
Interesting.
Right? Same thing with people like smoke weed or do psychedelics. Like everyone has their own thing. But like for me, like if I need to get work done that I'm pushing off, like sit down, wine, almost always get it done. It's weird. I used to write drunk and edit sober. Like that's like you hear people say that, but like it works. If it works for you, then do it. You know? So
For me, I think the big thing with the coffee is the placebo of like sitting down with a nice cup of coffee. Like, sure. Oh, now I'm working. Like you're saying, the ritual of making it. And then there's times like I drink my coffee or even in the morning, I make a full cup of coffee. I sit down to do work and I look over and I realize I've only taken like 2 sips, but I'm like, oh, I've got, you know, I'm in the zone. I've got a full cup of coffee, got some music on. I'm in the zone. I'm being so productive right now, even if I haven't really drank much of the caffeine.
Yeah. I mean, it's all about the rituals we create, right? And I think that changing the rituals are so hard. I mean, my girlfriend is a heavy, heavy coffee drinker. And the same thing, it's just more of a ritual thing for her, right? And she loves the taste and loves the caffeine as well. But like, I think, and I've told her this and she's like, yeah. You know, like, I was like, I think you have more energy if you stop drinking caffeine. And she's like, easier said than done.
Yeah,
and
I'm for
like,
sure.
And I'm like, same thing, she look at me and be like, I think you'd feel better in the morning if you didn't drink as much as you do at night. And I'm like, yeah, easier said than done.
yeah.
It's like, touche.
Like you said, everybody has their vices.
Everyone has their vices. And I'd like to, it's hard because I'm doing so much travel, but I'd like to get back to this place I had where like exercise and outside was my vice. And like that could mm-hmm. satiate everything else. And like, I want to get back into serious. Like when I was a cyclist, like you could not convince me to drink. Because mm-hmm. I was just like, I want to perform on the bike the next morning. And like, I kind of miss that drive towards that. And then when you do get the drink, you just enjoy it more.
You know,
you also get the drink less because it doesn't take as much to get you drunk. But
yeah, I've worked with a lot of successful people, which is interesting. And a common theme between all of them has been a significant amount of exercise.
Oh, yeah.
And I found for myself how important it is. Like I was saying, with being freelance and being able to make my schedule and do whatever I want, I've found just how important an hour of exercise a day is. I mean, like, obviously there's so many physical benefits, but the mental benefits of like processing what I want to be doing and what I need to do and, where should I go do this photo shoot? Oh, I need to solve this. And like, for me, that hour away from the computer and away from my phone and away from my camera is really, really, really important.
Do you have a routine with exercise or like a certain sports or pursuits or? I see surfboards in your truck.
Yeah.
Right here.
I've got a lot of surfboards, you know.
That's a hell of a workout.
Yeah. It's hard to have a good routine when you travel so much,
which
like my whole last year was all travel.
Yeah.
I was just saying to you before we pressed record, like I've actually been home for the last month, which I think is the first time I've been home
so nice,
for 30 days consistently. I think since I moved here the day after I graduated college, there's always been something. But this month, I've been huge on yoga, and what I've really started to like is a 10:30 a.m. yoga class.
Nice.
I'm
right in the middle of everything, yeah.
Yeah, it's perfect. No, why I love it is it forces me to get up and get like an hour or two of work done before, because I know I'm doing something at 10:30.
Yeah.
So it's motivating to get out of bed, make that cup of coffee, sure. get some stuff done. And I'm usually like, when I don't have yoga, I'm like, I have all day. I kind of warm up. I'm slow. But this forces me to be like, all right, what can I tackle now before yoga? Then I go to yoga, and like I was saying, I have that hour to process what's going on and what I have coming up and
sure.
what I need to do. And then I come home, shower, eat some food, make a second cup of coffee, sit down, and then I'm just I'm in the zone the rest of the day, which is a great routine.
Yeah, no, I mean, it forced me to think about a lot of things. Like, my girlfriend and I will debate about routine all the time. Like, which is best, because like her and I sometimes have polar opposite routines, and it's detrimental when you're sharing a bed with someone. You have like opposite routines, as I'm sure
totally.
You understand.
Yeah.
I mean, I've lived all lives. I've done the like work till 3 or 4 in the morning, wake up at 9, 10, go through the day, like, you know, do your own thing. I've done the also like wake up at 4:30, go work out for 2 hours, and like you literally get to 9 a.m. and you're kind of tired, but you've already gotten like everything done, and you're just like, I can chill the rest of the day, right? And go to bed at 6. Not that early, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But I think recently, like, I don't know, my favorite thing recently has been wake up around sunrise. So like I'll sleep more in the winter, which is natural for human bodies, and sleep less in the summer. And then like I like walking, like lower impact exercise, getting the heart rate up, getting the blood flowing, thinking, meditation, yoga, I think would fit in there too. Not too intense. Like, I don't want to do hot yoga first thing in the morning. Yeah. Like, I just want to stretch.
Yep.
But for me, like, I've learned that if I can wake up and I don't eat breakfast, so like wake up, get through everything, get the most important shit done, get all the crucial things done, then I have this like 10:30, 11, 11:30 period where I can go to the gym uninterrupted or go work out when everyone else is kind of frantic and starting their day, and then go eat lunch right after working out. So you feel like, you know, you can get those calorie goals, protein goals. I mean, that's a big thing recently, is I've kind of realized that like you can kind of eat like shit if you just consume a fuck ton of protein. That's what I've been learning recently. Because like protein is kind of everything. Lots of protein, lots of fat. Do you have any kind of like current diets or like things you follow around eating or anything like that?
I don't follow anything too rigidly. I just try and be pretty intentional about what I put in my body.
Sure.
I try to eat mostly whole foods.
Sure.
I definitely, you know, it's difficult, and I don't tie myself to anything, but I think it's pretty crazy what a lot of processed food in our society looks like and how terrible it is and how a lot of it should be probably illegal and regulated and all these things. And
you think?
Yeah. And I also think it's really easy to go down the rabbit hole, and especially in today's society, somebody tells you don't eat this, somebody tells you eat this, somebody tells you fat's good, somebody tells you fat's bad, yada yada. And I think the simplest way to go from there is, if I'm eating foods that come from the earth, whether that's fruits, vegetables, meats, cheeses, whatever,
I think it's pretty good. Yeah,
probably better than like a giant box of Cheez-Its or something that came from a lab.
Yeah.
And I try and just, again, really, I'm not perfect. It's super hard when you're on the road. But the more fresh food and food that comes from the earth I can eat, the better. And I try and just stick to that, and I don't try and overcomplicate it too much.
Yeah, I mean, I used to be an absolutist about it, and I think that's what kind of held me back for such a long time. Because I'd be like, I'd have this perfect streak, and then I'd like fuck it up slightly, and I'd be like, I have to restart, and like, you know,
totally.
Like, and going, it gets really toxic and caustic. And so like, I learned that like, if the overall 90% is good, that little 10% can be not the best. My favorite example is like, when I'm on the road a lot, like driving, middle of nowhere, you're not going to find the Whole Foods. You're not going to find the health food. You're not going to find like, and you're not going to bring a stove to buy some like nice beefy eggs, right? So the company Core Power and Fairlife both sell protein shakes that you can get at most like truck stops and grocery stores and stuff. And like, when I'm on the road, like, as much as I hate saying like I'm eating, drinking protein shakes, these are like from whey, from filtered milk. There's a couple additives in there for taste and for destabilization.
Yep.
But my number one rule is like, as long as it is originally originating from like an animal part. So I don't want like fake protein or pea protein or something else. Like, I want something that like way from milk, for example. And then part two is like, I don't want any seed oils in it whatsoever.
Yeah.
Because like that's the reason why I stopped drinking Muscle Milk. Because when they got bought by Gatorade, Coca-Cola's whole thing's about cost. And they use sunflower oil and the Muscle Milk, like to-go ones, to like bind it all together.
Yeah.
Which is like, you're basically just drinking the shit that your McDonald's fries are fried in. And my whole thing is this, it's like, if you want the fries, eat the fries.
Yeah.
Right? Don't go pretend you're doing something healthy, but you're still consuming the same thing, but worse, because it's actually being digested by you.
I've been in the same thing where I've tried to do protein drinks, or, you know, now they make protein cookies and all these things to put on muscle and yada yada, and I feel like over the years, again, I've just moved away from that into like, did this come from a normal source?
Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna eat it. So did it not? No.
So with me right now, and people find this interesting, is so like, I'm on this road trip. I'm only, what's today? Wednesday. Today's Wednesday.
Yeah.
5 days into it.
Yep.
I have a Yeti cooler in the back of my car, and there I'm like one of those people that, like, I love seltzer, like the can in front of you. I love water, but I like it to be cold. Like,
yeah.
Cold. Yeah. And so, like, that's most of the freezer. Sorry, the cooler. The rest of it's, like, some yogurt, some cheese, some fruit, but also, like, some meat. And my whole thing is, like, I personally prefer to go for the nicest quality possible. When you go on the Pacific Coast, that's very easy to do.
Yeah.
Right? When I start making my way across the country, less ideal.
Yeah.
So like I definitely be filling up my cooler with stuff and a bunch of other dry goods. And the last Whole Foods I pass in Arizona, absolutely.
Done that many times on photo road trips, especially when you're going to shoot in the Southwest, which I didn't learn before I did it the first time.
Oh, yes.
And then the second time, I will never again miss that Whole Foods in Vegas and just load up.
Yeah, because you realize like the next closest thing you can get is like beef jerky made on someone's back porch.
100%.
That's like the next healthiest
thing. It gets
thing
gnarly.
You can get.
You're eating at gas stations 100%. Yeah.
Oh, God, those gas station burritos are some of the.
Yeah.
It's like at that point, I'm like, I just need sustenance, but there's like no nutritional value. They don't taste good and they're made with shit. So, like, at the end of the day, like, what is the. I'm better off fasting.
Yes.
You know, but you're paying the ass because you're hungry.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
No, those Whole Foods are important.
Those Whole Foods. Not just that. I love the good. I think California has more of these than anyone else, but the good local natural grocer.
Yeah.
Like the in-town.
Yeah.
Kind of crunchy.
Totally.
Has local wines.
Yeah, the co-ops.
The co-ops. Yeah. No, I mean, I think also what I tell people, and I'm no expert, right? I just know it works for me. And then I also still know it works and still don't do it. But like, if you were to mirror what your ancestors were eating, that's probably a good place to start.
Yeah.
You know? You know, for me, mostly Scandinavian, like I can pretty much eat red meat and berries and starches and cheese and milk at any level without any kind of consequence from like internal. Like I also have friends who like my best friends when very dark skinned sub-Saharan African grew up in Cameroon, like he really struggles with that diet.
Yeah.
You know, so he eats a lot of fruit and tries different things, but like a lot of red meat he really struggles with.
Yeah.
Chicken, lighter meats he can do.
It's just like
what,
the cameras and the bikes. It depends what you're trying to do and who you are. And
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just licensed professionals who could probably tell you more than I could. That's
sure.
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I always say is, and I'll end with this, is like be wary of those who claim they have a fix-all solution.
Totally.
And also part two is like, if anyone says that like another thing is wrong, immediately disavow. Like if someone's like, oh, carnivore diet's wrong, be vegan, or vice versa, vegan diet's wrong, be a carnivore, like immediately throw out what they say.
Totally.
You know, because like you got to try it. You know, like I've tried all the Beyond Impossible meat and it makes me feel like ass.
Yeah.
Like I can't eat it. I can eat it, but I don't want to.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't make me feel good. But
totally.
I know plenty of people who work great on it.
Yeah.
And if that works for you, awesome.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah.
Do what makes you happy.
Depends on individuals, for
and
sure.
And stop virtue signaling. I don't give a shit that you're vegan or glutarded or whatever you want to call it. But, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, do what makes you happy.
Exactly.
Right? Hopefully what's making you happy is what's healthiest for you as well. But, you know.
Totally. Yeah.
So, but the beauty of America, in the words of Ron Swanson, if you want to eat this and balloon up to 500 pounds and die of a heart attack, you can. And that's your prerogative.
That's true.
Not my cup of tea. Cool. Well, I think you and I will probably try to meet on the road someday and do some specific podcast that takes place in some kind of adventure setting. I think that'd
be
fun,
awesome.
Especially a round table. If like I, you know, crash a shoot with you and Alex or someone else,
totally.
It'd be more fun to do a fun round table.
It'd be
so,
blast.
I'm going to get you out here in a couple quick rapid fire questions. You can answer these in as few or many words as you'd like. Is there a certain sound that you associate with happiness?
Well, it's funny because right now the birds are chirping when we paused, and that's nice. Especially, like I said, I go on a walk every morning.
Sure.
It's always pretty early. Birds are chirping, such sun's out, thing. Especially around here. And for me, that's like, I live a pretty busy life, and it's hard for me to appreciate the little things. But in the morning when the birds are chirping, I'm like, this is nice.
Yeah.
This is happiness.
Yeah, it's different in every place. Like, I've been lucky enough to live in many different places, and each place has its own different bird noises.
Yeah.
And you, at first, they're kind of like alien to you, and then you get used to it, and you're like, oh, that's just super comfy. And then, like, I think that noise, those birds, like the chickadees and the local little sparrows that live in these trees, especially places like SLO, LA, San Diego, like, whenever we got to your friend's house and you hear that, I'm like, it just takes me back to memories.
Totally.
And just like in New Hampshire, the birds up there are completely different. And you get back there, you're like, oh.
But it's peaceful. If you're somewhere and the sun's out and the birds are chirping, it's a good place to be.
I always love, and you'll get this from a New England perspective, like mostly fall, you'll hear the owls go the whoo.
Yeah.
Whoo, and it's like it'd be a lovely fall afternoon, the wind's
totally
blowing, and like that's New England. You wouldn't get that ever here.
Yeah, no.
That's New England.
Yeah.
Or the seagulls being annoying as shit. If you had to give a TED Talk, or you wanted to give a TED Talk, on something outside of like your normal profession and career, what would you give it on? So no photography.
That's a really good question. You know, I studied in college environmental communications, which was, there's a really interesting science to how you communicate to people what's going on with the environment.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating.
And
actually,
there's good ways to do it. There's bad ways to do it. And the ways that you do it greatly affect how the general public feels.
Totally.
And I feel like people need to know that. I feel like it would be good if people know that. And I feel like framing is everything. And if you could do a good TED Talk on that and explain to the public ways to be thinking about this,
what would you
probably
call
be
it?
A good thing. What would I call it? Do TED Talks usually have like a gimmicky name? I haven't listened to a TED Talk in a little while. I used to be on them.
The last woman I interviewed, Dr. Robin Buckley, her TED Talk, which went viral, was titled "Why I Bought My Daughter a Vibrator."
Wow.
Yeah, and it was all about how like, we as a society are so okay talking about women's pain and like periods and breast cancer and shit like that, but not okay talking about pleasure. Right. It was a very, very
totally
subtle point, right?
She sounds like someone who's thought about it
totally
and had a really good TED Talk on hand.
Oh yeah.
I don't know what I would name mine. I'd have to come up with a good, cause the name is everything. It's like the thumbnail.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Right. I'd have to have like a photo of myself.
So a better follow-up question would be like, Have you ever considered combining the work you do now with media and that kind of interest to create some kind of like, I think you could be very successful just from a personal perspective of like creating
totally
narrative around that.
Yeah. That was kind of the thought. Like I was saying, when I really specified that major, that was a junior year as I was kind of back into photography. And I thought being a photographer was an unrealistic career, but I thought that this would be a cool way to be in that world and like maybe working on like Nat Geo documentaries, that type of
who
thing, but not
happens,
not shooting. But there was a thought in the back of my mind of like, it would be really cool to pair. I didn't think I needed to study photography in college. There's so much you can learn by doing and on
it's
YouTube
like business.
And
like, don't study business.
And I thought, what could I study that would pair well? And that felt like it would pair well. And you know, I know like working with Chris and talking to him about it and other photographers, like there's a sentiment of like, people aren't going to want to protect the world if they don't care about it and know how beautiful it is.
Sure.
And I think that is really true. And I think that there's, again, like there's good ways to go about framing this message and bad ways. And I think in the future, it would be really cool to be working on more environmental focused pieces where I'm using my photography to show how beautiful places are and hopefully pairing them with writing and initiatives that are also trying to do good.
Backed by science and data that people can understand. That
yes.
Objective,
yeah.
Objective truths.
Totally.
Right.
And the difficulty is there's not a lot of money in those realms. There's,
yeah,
there's a lot
no.
of money to go shoot photos for brands, but there's not a lot of money to do science projects, you know? And so that's, hopefully that's an issue that's solved, but I think it'd be a really cool way to pair my two interests.
I think also beyond that, right? It's like, I was just thinking about the point you just made and connect something where it's like, you look at any of the climate rallies with like Greta Thunberg or anyone doing that. And it's just like, they have these bright yellow signs with ugly black topography. That's like, you're killing us and things like that. And I'm like, what if you just had this billboard of just like, you know, one of the beautiful coastal habitats is being destroyed right now. And it's like, protect this, right? That's a much more powerful story and emotion than like, you're killing us. You're going to destroy us. Cause like, for some people, right? I think Naval Ravikant talks about this. It's like he was like listening to a climate activist on Twitter, this is years ago, talk about how like India's pollution problem is destroying the world, and he's like honestly, like, another person's pretty woke, but it's honestly hilarious not even thinking of the fact that like these people are just trying to get out of poverty. They're not really thinking about like if the plastic they're using is polluting the planet. They're trying to feed their kids.
Totally.
You know, and it's like, I think
it's
first order world, you know,
reasons. Very nuanced. And
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And again, you know, there's ways to communicate that are effective and that aren't. And like one thing that is super prevalent is like if you're super doomsday and you talk about how the environment is, everything's warming up and the storms are increasing and it's, everything's going to perish and it's super fatalistic. Then what happens is individuals who you're trying to encourage to better their behaviors are like, the planet's fucked anyways. I'm not going to change my habits. Right. So you need to communicate how important it is. Mm-hmm. But if you make it, if it's a hopelessness, if you get to a point,
abundance and optimism mindset versus scarcity and pessimism.
Yeah. Mindset. So if you convince people that we're doomed, then they're not going to change their actions.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is, like, when people are like, you have to change your entire lifestyle and way of life to fix this one thing, like, that's not a very compelling narrative. But totally. Then all of a sudden, if you can say, like, hey, you know, there are little steps that you can do to make the area around where you and your family live and the local community and your future generations healthier.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah.
Both are achieving the same thing. One sounds a hell of a lot better.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It actually works.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So, interesting. And then let's see. If you could send a single push notification, this would be the last question, to everyone's phone in a given area, where would it be and what would it say?
That's a good question. A push notification. It would just say be kind. Mm. I think doesn't really matter where I am or what I'm doing, but I think if everybody just got a nice little reminder to be kind,
to
smile to the person next to them, wave.
Just don't be a dick.
Morning walk. Just don't be a dick. Yeah. I don't know what
you're
doing.
As most of the drivers
message.
In California are.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But I think it's just, it's easy to get caught up. Life is busy and it can be hectic and, you know, everybody's in their own race. And if everybody was just a little kinder to the next person, the world would be a good place.
Sure.
And it'd be really, like, imagine you're in a coffee shop, you're like stressed, you're doing something, or you're driving and there's some asshole tailgating you and you like get a notification on your phone and it just says, be kind. Like, where did this come from? Who sent this?
Yeah, I think 99% of the time I would be kind, except for the examples like yesterday where it's for some reason, and this is so strange, recently, it's always the like Tesla and Rivian drivers, always the electric car drivers that are the biggest douchebags while driving. And this one guy, I was driving through a small town in Marin, like population 400, small downtown, kids running around, speed limit is 25. I go down to like 28 and this guy's on my ass, flashing his lights, like trying to move. And I was just like,
what do you want?
But like, clearly there's a reason we're slowing down here. There's a kid running out into the street and things like that. And I'm like, I don't want to hit anyone.
Yeah.
And this dude, all he's worried about, I mean, who knows? He could be rushed to the hospital because he could be having a bad day. I don't know. At the end of the day, like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah. That's when you go a little bit slower.
Just a little bit.
Just
be nice. just like, look, I think the thing I always impart, and this comes back to environmental communication, right? Every action has consequences.
Yeah.
Right? Good and bad.
Yep.
Right? Just if people just thought in that mindset a bit more, I think we'd all be better off.
Totally.
You know?
Personally, professionally, you know, people always ask me, like, what's your advice for the industry or whatever? I'm like, just be nice. People want to acquaint themselves with other people who are nice.
Oh, yeah.
People want to be friends with people who are nice. People want to work with people who are nice. People want to give a cool work opportunity to somebody who's nice, you know, and it goes a long way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, people, look, there are two kind of realms of being an asshole. You know, I talked about this before we started recording, right? Yeah. There's like the Elon Musk asshole and there's like the dude down the street that runs a club asshole, right?
Yeah.
And like the Elon Musk will always be an asshole for different reasons, but also is getting significant shit done. And one could argue he can't really do the shit he's doing without kind of pushing the limits, in which case you become an asshole. But in the day, it's just like, you can be an asshole, but just don't be a dick.
That's true.
Right? Like, look at, we talked about Steve Jobs. Like, yeah. I think many people agree, like, he is an asshole. I think he owned that title, but I wouldn't say he's a dick.
Yeah.
You know, I'd say he's an asshole, but he's definitely not a dick.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's a fine line between being an asshole and a dick.
I agree. I'd also say most people 99.99% of people aren't Elon Musk and aren't Steve Jobs.
No.
And they could just be
kind. I said 99.99999.
Most people would benefit from just being slightly nicer through their day-to-day life.
Sure. Yeah, you're not as important as you think you are.
Yeah.
And on that note, anything else you want to plug, talk about, share? I'll share Instagram shortly.
So all right, cool. Yeah.
Anything else?
No, be kind.
Be kind.
Enjoy your life.
Cool.
That's all I got.
Because this is live and I do this very so often, I love doing this. Thank you all for listening to this episode of the Holocene Podcast. As always, you can find the show notes, everything online, attached below, wherever you want to find it. You can find Evan online at Evan Ruderman. That's how you pronounce it, right?
Yep.
Cool. That's Ruderman. Evan is spelled the normal Christian way. And you know my stuff at this point. So everyone have a great rest of your day.